Hello and welcome to Weapons and Warfare. For Straight Arrow News, I'm your host, Ryan Robertson. And as you can tell, we are on the road yet again, coming to you from the Air and Space Forces Association's Warfare Symposium in lovely Aurora, Colorado. Over the next few weeks, we'll be bringing you stories about the cutting-edge technology and strategic innovation on display here, as well as hearing from Air and Space Force leadership as they face the challenges of modernization and a new presidential administration. Just ahead on this episode, we hear from Generals Alvin and Saltzman, the Chiefs of Staff for the Air and Space Forces, respectively, as they work to set their branches on a course for success in great power competition. And in our Weapon of the Week, Lockheed Martin unveils a new cruise missile designed to strengthen U.S. defenses in the Pacific. We get the 411 on the CMMT, but first, some headlines you may have missed. In what can best be called a surprising move, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told U.S. Cyber Command leadership to pause all planning against Russia, including any offensive digital actions. While the full details of Hegseth's order are still a bit hazy, it's another signal of a shift in the White House's approach to Russia, likely aimed at normalizing relations after the U.S. and its allies largely isolated the Kremlin following its 2022 invasion of Ukraine. The duration of Hegseth's order is still unclear. What is known is that Cyber Command is working on a risk assessment for Hegseth, which will outline how his order impacts ongoing actions and what potential threats from Russia still exist. Another bump in the road for Boeing after the Air Force put a pause on deliveries of the KC-46 tanker. That's after cracks were discovered in two planes that were set to be handed over. The pause, first reported by the War Zone, was ordered in late February from the KC-46A program office, which noted that the cracks were found in the outboard fixed trailing edge support structure of the aircraft. Boeing, along with the program office and Air Mobility Command, is working to quickly figure out what caused the issue, as well as find short and long-term solutions. The Air Force and Boeing have known since 2018 that the KC-46, which is based on the commercial 767, could potentially develop cracks in the aileron hinges over time. However, finding cracks on brand new planes was a surprise, leading to the decision to halt the deliveries. Finally, a new order in the Army that's shaking things up a bit. Now, soldiers will be wearing the insignia patch of their garrison commander or their home base instead of their unit patches. To mark the change, units across the Army are holding patching ceremonies.
In many ways, we're coming full circle. The garrisons that supported our soldiers in Europe for 40 years all wore the 1st Armored Division patch, and it's great to see us returning to that historical tradition.
It's exciting. It is a very honorable occasion to be now part of this storied patch, this storied division, with its tremendous history going back through World War II.
The change comes from a directive given in January, which shifts the command structure for the garrison and headquarters staff that handled the day-to-day functions of Army bases. Previously, these staff members reported to Army Material Command, but now they'll answer directly to the base commander or the leader of the biggest unit on base for tactical decisions. The vibe of this year's AFA Warfare Symposium reflected this current moment in time. In a marked shift from 13 months ago, the level of reduced participation from policymakers and defense contractors, as well as Air and Space Force leadership, was noticeably down. Current events have left many of the people we spoke with feeling uneasy and unsure of what's ahead. For Generals David Alvin and Chance Saltzman, two men who, at least publicly, are very sure of the mission ahead and the direction they want their airmen and guardians pointed in, kicked off this year's event with messages of staying the course and doing whatever it takes. And that's the subject of this week's debrief.
A little more than a year ago, Air Force Chief of Staff General David Alvin spoke to a jam-packed house at the AFA's annual Warfare Symposium in Aurora, Colorado. Fast forward 13 months and one presidential election later, and the room was half full, an obvious signal that Air Force leadership is dialed in on what's coming out of the White House. Crowd size aside, General Alvin is very aware there is a new commander-in-chief, and he acknowledges some very tough decisions about the future of the Air Force will be falling on the desk of President Donald Trump. For his part, Alvin wants to make Trump's decision an informed one.
I think we need more options for the president. And that's what Air Power provides. More options for the president. Everything from rapid response all the way to decisive victory. That is what Air Power anytime, anywhere means. It's not just an aspiration, it's a promise that we have to hold.
Alvin believes the nation's security depends on reshaping the Air Force to address emerging threats, although the path to achieving this is still taking shape. At the same time, with Troy Menk nominated as the Secretary of the Air Force and awaiting Senate confirmation, efforts to adapt to current threats are on hold. Despite that, Alvin emphasizes the importance of reviewing past actions and future plans to align with the Secretary of Defense's priorities and hopes that proposed changes, especially those improving lethality and capabilities, will be embraced.
So I'm confident, and I actually look forward to when we get a confirmed secretary and undersecretary, because I have a hunch that when they see some of these things we're doing, we're going to be told to go faster.
The other half of the bill on day one of the symposium featured U.S. Space Force Chief of Operations General Chance Saltzman, who outlined the Space Force's priorities for ensuring space superiority. He stressed that the job is to control the space domain while denying it to adversaries.
Doing so under stressing conditions of crisis and conflict requires a purpose-built organization, tailor-made with the institutions, the equipment, the tactics, the training, the warrior ethos required to use military force to control the space domain. In other words, it requires a space force.
Saltzman also reminded attendees the U.S. economy, infrastructure, banking, and communication all rely on space. And he believes the U.S. and its allies must be confident they can operate successfully in an increasingly crowded and adversarial space environment, stating the Space Force should be seen as a warfighting domain, not just a support function.
We must think of space as a warfighting domain rather than just a collection of support activities. That the Space Force must organize, train, equip, and conduct warfighting operations as an integral part of the joint and combined force. And for this reason, Guardians are the warfighters with the unique education, training, and experience required to achieve space superiority.
General Saltzman also used the opportunity to announce two new initiatives. First, a new officer training course. It will be a 12-month program designed to give new officers a solid foundation in all aspects of space power. He also announced the creation of Space Futures Command, which will maintain the U.S.'s technical advantage by envisioning and planning for the future force needed to win wars in space.
Serving you clarity through context, our mission at SAN is to deliver the news straight down the middle. We're different from mainstream media because we spotlight distorted headlines and show you how to do it too. Discover stories that right and left-leaning outlets are choosing not to cover by using our Media Mist tool. Download the SAN app and turn on notifications to have straight facts delivered right to your phone or tablet, and get straight facts anytime at SAN.com.
All right, folks, for our weapon of the week, we are talking about Lockheed Martin's new low-cost cruise missile called the Comet. And with me now is Mike Rothstein with Lockheed Martin to talk to me about this bad boy. This came out around the same time as Rapid Dragon. That's the program of palletized cruise missiles at the back of a cargo plane. How did Comet come about with Rapid Dragon at around that same time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we understand that the U.S. Air Force, our U.S. Department of Defense, has a need to not only have the exquisite weapons that we make that are so well known and do a great job, but also to be able to come in at a place that's more affordable, that's easier to develop and produce, and go after a lot of targets if we get into a serious fighting war. And so the combination of Comet, which is really designed to be lower cost, more easily producible, more easily scaled in production, as well as be modular and updated along the way, you put that together with Rapid Dragon, where you're now delivering out of a cargo aircraft, and those two things become a really powerful deterrent.
You bet. And one of the things that Comet does for their for the U.S. DoD is lower the price point to get one of these, right?
Sure.
How was Lockheed Martin able to do that, to produce something that's with that lower price point?
Well, you know, keep in mind, it's they're different missiles, right? It's not going to do everything that a JASSM or a LRASM does. It's designed to be, right? So it's not going to have some of the exquisite sensors that we have in this. It's not going to have as big a warhead and some of the survivability techniques that we use. So we've made this very, very simple, right? So you're taking basic engine, basic warhead, a basic additive manufacturing, which can reduce some of your production costs. And you're getting really down to the basics, and you're focusing on how do I start from manufacturing as the going in premise and get a weapon that is good, but good enough as opposed to exquisite, as opposed to how do I solve the hardest operational problems there are.
You bet, you bet. And what kind of target sets are we imagining for the Comet?
I think it'll be a range of target sets. You know, we certainly understand that in tomorrow's war, the idea that targets are going to stay still and allowed to be shot is probably not going to happen. So we're really focused on as a baseline capability is the ability to hit a moving target or movable target. And from that, I think it can expand. It may be sea-based, it may be land-based. Right? And it's not going to have a huge warhead, so it's not going to go after your biggest, hardest targets, but it'll be able to hit a variety of things through there.
Absolutely. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks.
All right, folks, for Comms Check this week, we have an update with the VP of Strategy with Shield AI, Heath Niemi. Did I say that right, Heath?
You did.
All right, perfect. Heath, we're talking today about the VBAT drone. This is an update for our audience. We talked about this a couple years ago, but there's some updates to the VBAT. Kind of walk me through what's changed, what's new.
Sure. The new revised VBAT is a different sort of propulsion system. You can now fly using JP-5 heavy fuel, which is a big requirement, especially for the maritime forces.
Okay.
We also have a new landing gear set up for unassisted launch and recovery. We have, additionally, we have more fuel in this particular VBAT, so we're getting 12 plus hours of endurance, which is really critical for ISR missions, especially for strategic targeting. And that's one of the niches that the VBAT is filling the gaps, especially overseas.
When we talk about that different fuel, that's also a safety component as well on some of these ships, right?
Correct. That is a Navy requirement for JP-5 on board the ships.
And obviously other countries outside of the United States have VBATs. They're flying in Ukraine right now. Japan just bought some. What does that say about the VBAT's ability to fly in contested environments that it's still being used in Ukraine?
Sure. It's filling a gap right now in Ukraine for the contested environment for ISR, targeting, and battle damage assessment, which is crucial. Other countries are noticing this fact, because this is kind of the wave of the future. Additionally, there's other countries are very, very trusting in the VBAT's technology to launch and recover unassisted to meet their nation's different strategic goals.
And last question I had for you, the hive mind, the brains of the operation, that's something that can be taken out of the VBAT and put in other devices, correct?
Correct. Shield AI is an AI company, and hive mind, we are providing HiveMind to other airframes and other providers as well.
You bet. Heath, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All opinions expressed in this segment are solely the opinions of the contributors.
All right, folks, that's going to just about do it for us on this week of Weapons and Warfare. As always, please like and subscribe to our social media feeds. We really need your help growing the channel and spreading the message. This week's wrap is going to be a little bit different. Instead of giving you my thoughts on one topic in particular, I thought this would be a good opportunity to bring in Super Producer Brett Baker and kind of talk about our reaction to the show this year, because Brett, this show is a little bit different than the ones we went to last year.
That's absolutely the case. Fewer people, less participation. The contractors probably not as enthusiastic as they have been in some of the past shows we've been to.
Sure.
And just kind of the mood. There's an uneasiness or an uncertainty. I wouldn't call it, you know, fear or anything like that. But nobody knows which way it's really going to go.
Yeah. This is the first major defense expo that we've been to since obviously President Trump was elected back into office. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth had made a bunch of sweeping changes in the Department of Defense, and also President Trump had kind of changed the American tune, if you will, on backing for Ukraine. A lot of the officers here, a lot of the generals that we heard from this week, you know, their careers started back before the Budapest Memorandum, which was Ukraine's peace agreement to give up nuclear weapons in exchange for the U.S., the U.K., and Russia guaranteeing its peace.
We took several historic steps to ensure that the fear of nuclear confrontation will remain a relic of the past. As you know, Presidents Yeltsin and Kravchuk and I signed an agreement that commits Ukraine to eliminate over 1,500 nuclear warheads. We also agreed that the sovereignty and independence of Russia's neighbors must be respected.
A lot of these officers, they were around when that memorandum was signed, and fast forward to now, and the American change in posture towards an ally, that's leaving some, like you said, some unease and some trepidation within both the vendors and the military, to be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think everybody wants to talk, but I think they may not be too sure about what they want to say, because I think nobody wants to step over any boundaries, real or imagined. So I think everyone's, you know, just kind of taking a wait-and-see approach and playing it close to the vest.
Right. We just came out of a panel discussion called NATO in Action, and one of the first things the moderator said is, we're not going to talk about defense spending, we're not going to talk about anything overtly political, because we're not here to make headlines this morning, which to me is kind of the phrase of the week. People are here to make deals, but not necessarily to make headlines. There was a lot of At these shows, there's round tables where a lot of the upper tier officers are made available to media. And there is round tables scheduled to talk about Indo-PACOM, to talk about collaborative combat aircraft, to talk about Ukraine, to talk about NATO. And those were all canceled. That access to media.
Canceled or cameras were not invited in, which was not the case last year. Last year, we pretty much went to everything that we wanted to. And definitely a different tone coming out of those folks this week. And you can understand why.
Absolutely. Brett, really want to thank you for joining us and joining me on the trip. For those of you at home, Brett comes with me on these things. As a team, we kind of tackle everything we can. We have Chris behind the camera with us. So thank you, Chris. And for all you folks at home, once again, thanks for watching. Make sure you keep it tuned to Weapons and Warfare in the weeks ahead.